This podcast is intended for educational purposes only and is not medical or legal advice. Always follow your local policies, procedures, and protocols when functioning in your respective profession. Additionally, the views expressed by the speakers and owners of this podcast are their own and do not represent the views of their respective employers. Listener discretion is advised.
Alert Medic 1, respond.
Ken, Josh, and Mustafa here. Welcome back to the Alert Medic 1 podcast. Welcome back to the Alert Medic 1 podcast. Thanks for joining us tonight. Tonight we've got Chief Chris Way, who is the president-elect of the NAEMT, National Association of EMTs, which I'm sure all of you have heard about at some point. We've got him on the show to talk about a variety of topics about the NAEMT, and then we'll have a Q&A about other stuff. So, Chief, if you wouldn't mind introducing yourself to the audience.
Sure. Well, thank you guys for the invitation. It's a pleasure to join you tonight, or in the afternoon in my world. Chris Way, I'm the president-elect, as you said, of the National EMT Association. My full-time job is as a fire chief running an ALS transport service in Coeur d'Alene, Kootenai County, Idaho, which is Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. Been a paramedic for 30 years, been in the fire service for 32 years, and have held different roles, still in very involved in love, advocacy and legislation at the local, state, and national level. It's kind of one of my passions and hobbies, so it's interesting, and I look forward to discussing some of that. So thank you again, guys, for having me.
No, absolutely. Thank you for being on. Yeah, we're really excited to chat with you. So how did you get into EMS?
So I have a picture on my desk that was of my second birthday party, and it was my mom gave this to me a few years ago. That is of me sitting at the table, turning to with my fire chief helmet on and my fire truck themed birthday cake. And so when I was grew up watching Johnny and Roy and all of those things, emergency. And then when I was 16, had the opportunity to join the fire department as a junior volunteer, started my fire service career as a volunteer firefighter, went to EMT class my senior year in high school, or my junior year in high school, went to EMTI class at the time. That was before AEMTs. Went to EMTI class as a senior in high school. And then I started paramedic class 2 weeks after I graduated high school. And the rest is history.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's really cool. How did you get from being with your career department to being involved with the NAEMT?
Okay. So how I got involved in NAEMT?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So NAEMT, I was in Kansas at the time that I started getting involved as the president of the Kansas EMS Association. I had worked in Kansas and grown up in Kansas and before moving to Idaho about 11 years ago. And I was the president of Kansas EMS Association and had served on the board there for a while and just started getting involved in NAEMT. And then when I moved out here, a couple years after moving out here, there was an opportunity to run for a regional position, the Northwest region, the NAEMT representative. And so I took a shot at it. I'd been an NAEMT member. I knew people who were on the board. They encouraged it. And I took a shot. And so now I've served as a regional person. I've served as the national at-large person. Then I served as the treasurer. And now in my role, ran for president-elect. And so president-elect is a six-year cycle. It's 2 years as president-elect, 2 years as president, and then 2 years as past president.
Oh, interesting.
So I've been on the board for about 7 years now at this point.
Did you retire out of Kansas and then move to Idaho to get
the fire chief? No, I took an opportunity here in Idaho that couldn't – and look back now, and it's the best decision we've ever made, but moved out here 11 years ago in September.
Gotcha. So talking about the NAEMT, so I'll be honest with you, I kind of heard about the NAEMT. I didn't become a member until last year.
Well, thank you for becoming a member.
Yeah, well, we'll get into why I became a member later, but it was just interesting. You know, I knew that the NAEMT existed. I'll be completely honest with you. I used to regularly confuse the NAEMT with the NREMT, and obviously got that figured out, sorted out for myself. But, you know, just going into the, you know, I've had conversations like with the current president, and we've, you know, we've had a few conversations. I've done some more research. So I really wanted to first highlight what the NAEMT actually is, what you, you know, what the NAEMT does, and then kind of go into the specific legislative, you know, priorities and stuff that you guys had, that we had talked about offline. So if you don't mind.
Perfect. So the NAEMT is a professional organization. It's a membership driven organization. So we have about 78,000 members, if you include all the people that have taken their classes, their PhDLS and their AMLS classes and things in the past year. We have, and then what we are really, we have two kind of silos then, I would say, after that. We really focus on education. Like I said, there's a huge focus on teaching PhDLS, AMLS, the new mental health resiliency classes and things like that. And then advocacy is another big piece, and advocating for the EMS profession, and then working with other professional organizations on advocacy. So, for instance, I'm sure Dr. Lawler is probably a member of ACEP and maybe even the EMS physician, National EMS Physicians Association. We work with all of those folks, the International Association of Fire Chiefs, the IAFF, the International Association of Firefighters, the AAA, the American Ambulance Association, working with all of those people to try to pass and move or move EMS as a profession forward.
Yeah.
So that in a nutshell is really the focus of NAEMT as a membership organization.
Okay. Talk about some of the legislative stuff, you know,
so
specifically
some of the
like
things right now we're working on heavily are the Siren Act. So the Siren Act was initially passed a year and a half ago with initial funding for rural EMS agencies to provide both equipment and training at $10.5 million. We're happy to announce it just got reauthorized for $11.5 million this year, with the hope of taking it to 31 or 32 million next year to benefit rural EMS agencies or any agency providing EMS in a rural set.
So EMS counts, requiring the Secretary of Labor to revise the standard occupational classification system by dividing the, so if you could talk on that.
Yeah, EMS counts is a great example of I know Josh said he was a firefighter paramedic, and I know Dr. Lawler started in the fire service. So with that, right now, the Bureau of Labor or the Department of Labor only counts people as EMS providers if they work for an EMS only agency. And so when you come to an event like COVID, for instance, where they're handing out PPE or they're mandating PPE, but only giving it out in allotments to certain professions, EMS was counted for EMS only practitioners, not counting people who may be firefighter paramedics, something like that. So for instance, Josh and I would not have been counted in the world of figuring out that, because technically we work for a fire agency, even though we, and I think Josh's agency too, we are the primary EMS providers in our community. We are the only EMS provider in our community. We do all of the transport, ALS, BLS, that's who we are. But because we work for the fire service, we weren't counted as EMS providers when the Bureau of Labor and the Department of Labor set those standards. So this actually would require them to count anybody that provides EMS service into the EMS pool, so that, again, as we have an event like a pandemic or anything where resources are scarce, we make sure that we have the right number of EMS providers. And I'll use our state for example. Most of the services in Idaho, 70% of the EMS calls in the state of Idaho are run by a fire department. Every state's different. I totally, and I'm not suggesting that one method, I don't believe there is one type of provider that is better. I think you can point to great examples of fire-based, third service, hospital-based, private, nonprofit, for-profit, third service, but you can equally point to bad examples of all of those in the United States. I don't believe EMS is the delivery model you choose. I think it's the effort you choose to put in your delivery model that's important. And so why I say that is, in our community, they feel like EMS is best served in the fire agency. Sounds like it's that case with Josh's community as well. That said, we don't count when that happens. And so this really is legislation to make that count. Another big one that we're working through right now is a bill on treatment in place. You know, as you know, and this will come up, I know you're itching to get to the conversation about paramedic practitioners, and so am I. But I mean, one of the reasons that it's EMS doesn't, we're so antiquated in our payment methods. So right now, the only way EMS gets reimbursed for their service is if we transport a patient to the emergency room. Whether or not that's whether or not it's appropriate to transport the patient to the emergency room. Maybe we transport them to an alternate destination, like an urgent care or a physician's office or something like that. Or maybe we just provide excellent treatment at home through an MIH program and refer them to their physician later on or something. None of that gets paid by CMS or Medicare. And in our world, 68% of our patients that we see on a daily basis are Medicare patients. And so the treatment in place bill that has been introduced is really focused on paying EMS to provide the correct level of treatment, even if that means not transporting the patient.
Now, is that the TIP and TAD legislation? Yep. Okay.
Yes, it is.
For some clarification on that, Chief. So the bill is called treatment in place, but this means that a change to maybe not so much the Medicare schedule, but the reimbursement for all treatment that we do.
Right.
Whether we're transporting or not, because right now it's only if we transport, we don't get money for doing the 12 lead and giving this med and that med and this intervention and that intervention. This would bring money back to the individual agencies for the actual treatment that is rendered while en route to the hospital or at the scene and
you this know, is specific release. To at the scene right now.
Okay.
Where they're still sticking to their guns on that is, that's why they have the different levels of treatment that you get reimbursed for in a transport. So you have BLS, you have BLS non-emergent, you have ALS, you have ALS-2, which is like a cardiac arrest. You have to give three or more medications, or you have to do certain interventions that make it an ALS. Intubation required becomes ALS-2. Any critical care skills are ALS-2, or critical care transport if you have critical care transport license. But it does not change that pay schedule. It's okay. Really just focused on the treatment in place
to try and boost MIH programs.
Not even MIH programs. So we do not currently run an MIH program here because we don't have the support of our local hospital to do it. And so we really don't feel like we can put those. It's only good if you have partnerships. That's actually why while I like the title mobile integrated healthcare, I almost liked when we called it community paramedicine better. And the reason is because I think it was so dependent on what your community needs. I mean, if you've seen one community paramedic program or one MIH program, you've seen one community paramedic program. And really my community needs something different than your community, which is different than somebody else's community. But a strong partnership with the hospital is key to that. And what we don't have right now, I mean, that's unfortunate that we don't have that. But that said, we still may go out today and provide some great treatment in place. A diabetic patient, go provide treatment in place for them. But right now we're not going to get paid. And that's not somebody that needs to go to the hospital. That's somebody that we need to regulate their blood sugar immediately from an emergent crisis, but probably contact their physician or make sure that they've got food to eat or, you know, whatever it is. But I don't know that that's a patient that needs to go in the back of an ALS ambulance to an ER, take up an ER bed for the physician to say, well, your blood sugar is good now. Let's get you an appointment with your regular physician. So I don't think it's limited to treating in place and maybe even at the BLS level as well. I mean, we've all run calls. I'm sure all four of us have run calls where we shake our head and say, why are we here for this call? But they do need some level of treatment, even if it's just community support or something like that. So anyway. That's probably a longer explanation than you wanted.
No, that was awesome.
Yeah, that was great.
No, thanks for that clarification because, you know, while treat in place, it is there. That can be a little ambiguous at times for some people and having a clarification, understanding, and, you know, we don't always know what's going on at the federal level. So getting that explanation will tell people how they can properly advocate for that thing if that's what they're looking for their department or their area.
And that doesn't mean that we're not still fighting for payment reform and EMS completely, because I think, I mean, again, not to jump ahead too far, but I mean, Mustafa, you and I's conversation a couple of months ago when we set this up was, listen, it's not as simple as just changing the title and thinking more money is going to come in because we change a title or we change something. You've got to have the laws to support it. And unfortunately, nothing that we do in EMS is like it was 25 years ago. But guess when the last time we changed payment methods in EMS was 25 years ago. So we don't treat chest pain like we did 25 years ago. We don't do CPR. Hell, we don't do CPR like we did 10 minutes ago, let alone 25 years ago. We don't extricate people out of vehicles like we did 25 years ago, but we still are paying for EMS like we did 25 years ago. And so I think it's, I mean, treatment in place is one step, but it is certainly not the payment reform that needs to happen to better fund, or appropriately fund the delivery of EMS.
I think what you said is really important about how it's multifactorial. I mean, in my current large jurisdiction that I oversee, I mean, we run 185,000 calls per year. We transport about 90,000 of them. And we have all the pearls, pitfalls. We've been through failed AT3 models. But I think the challenge you've really echoed is the fact that, you know, people are looking for a magic bullet, but we've really got to look at EMS as the practice of medicine. And the practice of medicine, quite honestly, is also the practice of payment. And if you don't have a flexible payment model, you're not going to incentivize hospitals or other partners for that matter. So I just wanted to echo the fact that, you know, when you come at it from an area that, you know what, this is part of the challenge. And I'm sure, even though I have never practiced paramedicine in Idaho, I'm sure we would be very keen to look at some very similar challenges with United that unite us all. And the payment reform is so well said.
Something you just said, I think, is really interesting. So getting to do this on a national level or national stage has really taught me the issues. To your point, the issues that I'm having in Idaho are the same issues that they're having in Los Angeles, or they're having in Maryland, or they're having in Florida, or they're having in Texas. You know, it's scalable, right? Your issues are scalable. And so you've got to figure out, and we're all fighting for limited resources. We're fighting for the same people. And so you've got to figure out how to accomplish those things in your world. But the more we can have a collective voice, our federal partners. So if I'm on the Hill and I go talk to the representatives in Maryland, they're going to go, what the hell does a guy in Idaho know about EMS in Maryland? And I don't have a great answer, no different than if you three went and talked to one of my senators from Idaho, they'd go, do you even know where Idaho is? And that's okay. But if we're all singing the collective song and you guys are saying the same things to your folks as I'm saying to my folks, and then we're getting, you know, this is cross political boundaries. This is all types of jurisdictions. Again, this is all types of models. This is fire-based, third service-based, nonprofit, for-profit. All of these delivery models are affected by how EMS is paid for. And unfortunately, EMS is a revenue. You have to have patient revenue to pay for EMS. Whether that's right, whether that's wrong, we can debate that another time. But the fact of the matter is, in 2024, that is still how we pay for the delivery of EMS in the country. And right now, the only way that EMS gets delivered is if we transport a patient to the ER.
So Dr. Lorna brought up something that I wanted to talk to you about, and that was the ET3 and the early ending of it. So from my understanding, and for folks that don't know, I'm just going to read from their page just real quick what it was. So the Emergency Triage, Treat, and Transport program was a voluntary 5-year payment model that provided greater flexibility to ambulance care teams to address emergency health care needs of Medicare fee-for-service, right? Beneficiaries following a 911 call. CMS continued to pay to transport a Medicare FFS beneficiary to a hospital emergency department or other covered destination. In addition, under the model, CMS paid participants to, number one, transport to an alternative destination, which could be a primary care facility, urgent care, or a community mental health center, or initiate and facilitate treatment in place with a qualified healthcare partner. So, like I said, it was ended early, and the reasons cited were this decision was made due to lower than expected participation and lower than projected intervention. So I want to give it back to you, Chief, just, you know, your thoughts on the whole ET3 model and, you know, why it failed and other thoughts you may have.
I think they made it so restrictive. So they wanted to pilot a program, but they made the program so restrictive. I would point to us. I think we were a prime candidate to start it. And we missed it by 2 points. Well, we didn't even apply because we knew we'd miss it. So one is you had to have alternate care destinations 24 hours a day available. Well, all of our urgent cares close at 10 p.m. They're open from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. So automatically we don't have 24-hour alternate care destination. And I honestly, off the top of my head, I forget the other piece, but they made it such a restrictive program that people didn't sign up. And then they struggled because they didn't have the federal government, and this may shock you, the federal government wasn't ready for it. And so when they started asking for some of their data and their information that they needed back, they didn't have a method to give it, or they didn't have a reporting mechanism, or but then they just ended it without any warning. They literally sent out an email and said, hey, guess what? Sucks to be you. And I mean, people that I know that were participating in the ET3 trials said it was just overnight, like no warning, no nothing. And we still haven't gotten it. We wrote letters, we contacted people. I can't tell you that we've ever gotten a clean explanation of why.
Yeah. Who, and I think I already know the answer to this, but like, who kind of created the plan, and did they even talk to EMS?
I don't know that I have a great answer for you, because I can tell you that I know people who were involved in the initial stages, but they certainly weren't the founders or initiators. I have to believe part of it happened out of, it had started before COVID, but then, as you guys know, EMS became the Swiss Army knife of healthcare and COVID. Like,
oh yeah,
hey, we need a vaccine clinic. Who should we call? Well, hell, let's call the ambulance. We set up a mobile field hospital. The governor said, well, call the fire department. They'll do anything. And he's not wrong, but it's like, I don't know. I'm going to our hospital saying, I need doctors and nurses, because as it turns out, fire department doesn't have a lot of those. And so, you know, it's just, I think we proved ourselves, but, and showed that during COVID, there were so many things that we could do. People probably thought this was a genius thing to be thinking of. And it's not that it wasn't, but they made it so restrictive. And what you, to me, and this is Chris's magic world, and I don't live in it, I just dream in it. And that is, if I was designing the program, I would make it less restrictive up front, get my data in, try to figure out how this was really truly affecting patient care, and then come out with my rules afterwards. But they came out with all the restrictive rules up front, and then can't imagine why we didn't get the participation that they had hoped to get.
Yeah. I would totally agree.
Doc, I was going to ask, what's your comments?
I mean, we only have 2 hours, so I would just say we were a participating jurisdiction that needs lots of help. And to set the stage, I mean, we need paramedics to staff the ambulances. We need ambulances. We need ambulances that aren't broken, medical, I mean, the whole bit. So ET3 is an interesting experiment, and I would agree with a lot of what's been said, is we can't look at these things as a magic bullet. They have to operate within a system. So when this drops onto a jurisdiction that is used to, as you mentioned, transporting everybody to the hospital, imagine what happens when you say to urgent care centers, hey, we're going to take these patients that have multiple comorbidities, that haven't seen a doctor in 8 years, that may or may not have any degree of, you know, whichever insurance reimbursement, we're going to get them to an urgent care center. Now, these urgent care centers, like you're talking about, have never been integrated in EMS systems either. So I think there are a lot of benefits to the idea of thinking about a model. And I would absolutely agree that we need flexible reimbursement. We need to have less restrictions. But the challenge is, this was kind of put on top of a system that didn't work that way. And the integration was very challenging. So our utilization rates were terrible, but they were terrible for, I think, a variety of reasons, not only because of the structure, but because EMS, I think, also has to be very flexible and structured on the front end. And unless you integrate these ET3 projects into a larger system of adequate call tree, I think it's something that is not going to be the magic bullet for decreasing ER utilization. And that's a whole other issue, right, is what the role of the ER is. But there's always room. There's always something to be learned. But we were not that upset to see it go away.
Yeah. So from the field provider side, like, I can't confirm, but I believe my jurisdiction was a participating jurisdiction as well. I know we had an alternative destination policy, and it just wasn't used. And one of our issues was that, when it was introduced to us, and the facilities that we were taking to, we predominantly go to pick up from.
Yeah.
So like, you know, we're sitting here thinking, why am I taking a patient here that has a strong likelihood I'm going to see again in a couple hours when this urgent care or alternative destination determines that, oh, we can't handle this patient now, even though they fell within the criteria. They, you know, we accept this patient, we're calling back, and we're sending them out. And so we ran into that issue numerous times, and it just, from, you know, EMS leadership stated it was unfortunately a failure of a program, because we just didn't have this integration. And one of the facilities that we find that we work with a lot, that was one of these alternative destinations, has now become a big project within our agency. We were finding issues with the training of the providers at the facility between, are they an ER doc originally or a family med doc? The family med doc calls for EMS a lot more than the former ER doc, or the ER doc that's moonlighting at this alternative destination. And so you know, there was no cohesion. There was no understanding between EMS and the facilities on what was going on, at least at the field level. And I can't speak to the upper echelons and the brass on this side of the things, but at the field level, we didn't trust that these patients weren't going to become our patients again in a couple hours.
Well, so I think it's really, you bring up an interesting point. And this kind of goes back to Dr. Lawner's point. And that is, if you look at how they set up the trial, what they should have done is had systems like mine or yours or somebody come up and say, hey, let us trial this, but let us do it on our thoughts. You know, here are the problems in our system. So I can tell you, like, alternate care destination, wait times in an ER. I mean, you know, if it's a Friday afternoon, I can tell you our wall times in an ER are 43% higher than they are on a Tuesday morning, right? I mean, we have that data, but they didn't let us do any of that. It was so restrictive that I couldn't have gone and said, let me make this the Kootenai County Fire and Rescue Program. Let me, you pay me for a year. I mean, let's agree upon you're going to pay me $200 for every time I do treatment in place instead of $800 for transport, you know, whatever it is. Let me do that for a year and let me bring you the data to show you the difference. But then I'm setting the program up where I can go to the urgent care and say, hey, this is how we want to partner and we want to work together. And for us, 60% of our urgent cares are actually owned by the hospital system. So I don't have that, like, it's different maybe for you, but in our world, that does relieve some of the ER and ER overcrowding. And that doc isn't going to, because they're being told how to do it from the hospital system, we're not going to take patients that we then think are obviously going to turn around in 2 hours and get a 911 call at the urgent care. But that wasn't part of the program. They didn't let us do it. It was restrictive. So we couldn't bring our ideas to the table. And if we're serious about changing and reforming how we practice EMS, and I use the term practice purposely, if we're serious about changing how we practice EMS, we've got to get people like Josh, who are doing it on an ambulance every day as part of it. We've got to get people like Dr. Lawner, who are practicing medicine in the ER and receiving the patients, as well as a medical director for an EMS agency. We got to get people like me, who have to figure out budgetarily what to mm-hmm. do and how many more people. And instead of an ambulance, do I put these people in an alternate response vehicle or do I, you know, that's my job. And then I got to get somebody like Mustafa from the state who's going to say, you know what, Chris, you're absolutely right. We're going to give you an exception to the rules on these five rules for the next year while you trial this program. But until you get all of those people at the table together and you just have the federal government tell us what the program is going to look like and how we should do it and what they think is best, it is going to continue to be a failed problem.
So what's the what are some examples of how the NAMT for issues like this and others get your voice heard with places like CMS, right? Or agencies like CMS? Like, how does that what's the boots on the ground like look like?
Well, so that's an excellent question and something when I got involved with an NAMT years ago, and then, like I said, been on the board for about 7, maybe 8 years now, advocacy was probably a 25% of our world, where education was 75% of our world. And I would say it's an even 50-50 balance now. And one of the things that we did very purposely was we hired a lobbyist. And you don't want to think of EMS as being political, right? None of the four of us got an EMS thinking, holy crap, what I'm going to do is be a politician. No, we got in it very altruistically because, man, when I was 16, I was going to make a difference. I wanted to be a junior fireman and I wanted to be a paramedic and I wanted to be just like Johnny and Roy out there popping tops on my dextrose and people waking up and saying, you saved my life. Okay, I get all. But the reality is, again, we've got people making rules. So we have hired probably in all of the big organizations. So as I mentioned, the AAA, the IAFF, the International Fire Chiefs Association, all have lobbyists. And what we have all agreed to do together to advance EMS is we are going to sing each other's praises. We are not going to disagree in public. And when one organization has an issue that the others may not feel as passionately about, we'll either support them or we'll remain neutral, but we won't oppose them publicly. And that has been probably the biggest thing. And The other thing about it, and this is frustrating to those who aren't familiar with the system, but federal legislation doesn't turn on a dime. And so it's interesting because we form up. See, I love it. I'm getting to see Dr. Lawner as a
great. That was for you. I just wanted to
as a younger man.
There you exactly. It's the Squad 51 analogies to frame your amazing commentary.
Yeah, I love it. And so the problem is federal legislation takes long. So yes, we've been talking about these things for years. But when I'm in my representative and senator's offices every year talking about it, they at least remember it. And the other thing that's happened is now we form those relationships. And so when there is something that comes across their desk that says EMS, they go, oh, God, I got to call that Chris guy, because he's the guy that's in my face every time he sees me about payment reform or treatment in place or whatever those things are. And so as long as, I mean, it's a painful, slow process for anybody that thinks, and it's not necessarily at the state level. We actually see state EMS legislation flow through reasonably quickly, almost too quickly sometimes, because sometimes you'll get a senator, a state senator or a state representative who gets a wild hair and talks to one person, writes a bill, doesn't bother to talk to other providers, and then we've got a negative impact. That doesn't happen at the federal level. Moving stuff at the federal level is like trying to move an iceberg or melt an ice, you know, it just doesn't happen. And so probably how we combat that the best is we get experts together on certain subjects. And there's subjects that I'm much more passionate about in the world of legislation. And there's subjects I'm not the guy to talk to you about, because we need more providers or we need the physicians or something. I'm actually working right now with NAMSP. We just talked about the National EMS Physicians Association. Their incoming president is actually the NAMT medical director, Doug Kupas from Pennsylvania, and their advocacy chair and I, because I'm the advocacy chair for NAMT, and the two presidents are getting together to work on some cooperative legislation that benefits EMS and benefits EMS physicians. But we know that it's a better voice together than if I get a phone call from my senator saying, hey, what do you know about this NAMSP legislation? And I go, well, I don't know. I have no idea. It's not going to go anywhere. Likewise, if Doug gets a call from somebody, I don't want him to say, yeah, I don't know what you're talking about, NAMT's legislation. So making those people talk, or having those people talk and having the organizations talk together, has probably been one of our biggest successes. And you see things like the Siren Grant is only 2 years old, or this is the third year we're applying now, but that took us 10 years to get through the legislative process. So I want to get excited about some of these things. I think probably of the things I see right now of the legislation we've talked about, Siren's already approved. The next piece, I really do believe treatment in place, probably because COVID was in our face and showed us the importance of treatment in place, probably has the next best shot of legislative passage. But man, some of this stuff is just going to take a while. But if we didn't have boots on the ground in Washington, D.C., I can make phone calls, I can send emails, I can have Zoom calls, I can do all those things. But having that presence at the Capitol every day on EMS issues has been what has been most successful for NAMT.
So when you say the presence, that's what you mean by like the lobbyists that you guys have there?
Yep, absolutely.
Right. Okay.
So we have a full-time lobbyist whose only job... She is great. She actually was a Hill staffer, and so she understands the ins and outs of the Capitol. Her mother actually ran a volunteer ambulance squad in New Jersey for years and years and years. She, previous to our lobbyist, she was a hospital lobbyist, and so she understands healthcare, she understands EMS, and she understands the Capitol. She's not an EMS provider. We can gather paramedics. I could probably call Josh tomorrow and say, Josh, I need you to come to Washington, D.C. on Thursday, next Thursday, and be in a meeting to be the subject matter expert. But what Josh can't do on most days is get me in the door to that meeting. That's what the lobbyist can do, because she's there every day saying, hey, I need somebody at this meeting for the Ways and Means Committee, because they're going to discuss this, and this is important to our profession. And having that person there connected all the time, who knows the staffers, who knows the committee chairs, That has been game changing for us.
So where do and I did not know these two entities existed until the whole paramedic practitioner thing went down. Where does the Federal Interagency Committee on EMS and the National EMS Advisory Council fit into this picture that you're painting?
Well, it is an interesting you bring that up, because I would tell you they exist, but no one really has a ton of information. So right now, EMS's official federal home is NHTSA under the Department of Transportation, the National Highway Traffic Incident Safety or Administration, under the Department of Transportation. If you ask Secretary Buttigieg whether he knew he had EMS underneath him, I would tell you he would probably say no, because no one really knows that. That's actually been one of our federal initiatives in the past, is we need to find a home for EMS, whether it's, and I've heard millions of things floated. So I know that the Secretary of Homeland Security has tried to put it recently in the fire administration as a fire-based provider. I don't know that that's a bad idea. I know that leaves a bad idea in other people's mouth, or, you know, is it Health and Human Services? I don't know that I have the answer. What I can tell you is not having a really solid, good federal home hurts EMS, because law enforcement has the Department of Justice. Fire agencies have the National Fire Administration. EMS has, and you mentioned two of them, but again, NHTSA's involved, Department of Transportation's involved. Not having a federal home is a much bigger anchor to EMS than I think anybody realizes.
And not to like try and open a rabbit hole here, do you think that part of it is because EMS is not recognized as an essential service?
I think it is. So it's interesting. And that's, I'm glad you, so I want to go down that rabbit hole for just a second since you said that. But so essential service is actually something that's done at the state level. So right now there are 17 states that have EMS as an essential service, but the others don't. Idaho has a bill right now to put to, and it's in committee, to make EMS an essential service, and actually to take the office, the Bureau of EMS, out from health and welfare and put it in the Office of Emergency Management, not because we think emergency management is the best place for it, but because the health and welfare budget is so big and the health and welfare department is so big, and EMS's 13 or 17 state employees, whatever it is, are so lost in the thousands of health and welfare employees, EMS just isn't important. And so I take what's going on in Idaho and take that to a federal level and go, how many federal employees are truly working on EMS? I don't have an answer. I'm asking, I mean, and I'm not asking the question because I think I'm not putting you on the spot, but I don't think any of the four of us can answer that. But if you went to the Department of Justice and said, how many people are working on law enforcement issues? I bet they could give you a pretty good answer and a good field on how to do that. If you went to the fire administration and said, man, how many of you are working on tech rescue? And how many of you are working on smoke detector safety and fire prevention and all of the things that fall in the fire world? I bet they could give you an answer. No one can give us an answer on who, when, how, many, any of that. The who, what, when, where, and how of EMS is lost at the federal.
Yeah, I know NHTSA has an office of EMS, but I couldn't tell you how many people work there. But yeah, no, I am. That's
funny,
certainly an interesting
story
question.
About the NHTSA thing. I was recently doing recruiting at a local college that Moose and I both went to, and the booth next to us was NHTSA. And I said to the engineer, I'm like, did you know that EMS falls under your agency? And she goes, excuse me?
Yep.
Now, she's an engineer. I'm not too surprised that she didn't know, but she was quite surprised that NHTSA overall is the governing body of EMS at the national level. So just a weird coincidence that they were next to us. And I was like, I got to take this opportunity to be like, do you know this?
Were you surprised? No. Were you disappointed? Yes. But I mean, that's, and again, I'm not advocating for a certain home. I think we've got to find a federal home though, where EMS becomes an important, and it's the old battle, is EMS public safety or is EMS healthcare? I would argue it's both. It's probably a hybrid of both, but we got to figure out someone to be our champions at the federal level.
Yeah, no, I can certainly, you know, agree with that. The just thinking about it, you know, we came from, you know, those, you know, what is it, the accidental death and disease? I forget the name of the 1966 paper, right? That kind of started all this.
And it was.
EMS, and of course, you know, we got to, you know, pay tribute to those folks. Those are those that, you know, helped start EMS, but now we kind of have to put it into second gear, right? Now we've kind of been going around on the same thing for what, 50 years, 60 years. We kind of got to, you know, put it back, you know, as my one of the leaders at where I work would say, double clutch it and throw it back into gear and probably the next gear up, right? So so that leads me to, you know, let's talk about the paramedic practitioner thing, right? Because we, like I said, I didn't know what the NEMSAC was. I didn't know what the FIC EMS was. And I just want to give some background for folks that may not know what we're talking about. So the National Emergency Medical Services Advisory Council, NEMSAC, I forget exactly when they proposed it, but I have the proposal here and we'll attach a PDF to it. I have the date right here, June 27th, 20th, had a 7-page draft, that I have in front of me. I don't know what the final paper was, length was, but basically they described and, stated that they had a draft recommendation for a graduate prepared paramedic practitioner. When I initially heard about it, I was like, oh, okay, this is interesting. I, you know, on surface value, it's certainly something that, I would find interesting. So I was certainly disappointed when I saw this draft letter going around, mainly on social media, who knows if it was even supposed to get out or not, that, was from the American Ambulance Association, the IAFF, the International Association of Fire Chiefs, IAFC. The IAFF as well, the International Association of Firefighters, and the National Association of EMTs, right? NAMT. Mm-hmm. So when I read the letter, I was pretty infuriated. I think I communicated that pretty clearly with the rest of the team. And that's kind of when, you know, I started doing more research. And then when I had the opportunity to, you know, get someone from, you know, the NAMT on, I wanted to, you know, just chat. So I wanted to start this off first with kind of getting your background on like the initial proposal and then your just thoughts on the your idea of the proposal itself from the Chris Way perspective. And then let's transition to the NAMT side.
So the Chris Way perspective, we'll start. Well, first of all, I guess this is multi-part. So I can tell you how it was presented to those organizations. We got that same draft letter and we weren't asked for input. We weren't asked our opinion. We were just asked to sign on in that form or not sign on. And okay. We could not sign on in that. I mean, there were things in that form that we said, whoa, like this, it wasn't a collaborative effort. So all those organizations you just mentioned, when one of us comes up with a new idea, we generally get together and say, hey, what are people's thoughts so that we don't have an ugly incident where we're writing letters opposing it or not supporting it or something like that? That didn't happen from NEMSAC. NEMSAC gave it to us and said, here it is, sign on. And we said, ooh, how about some input? And we weren't given input. None of those organizations were given input. It was either support it in its current form or don't. So let's start with that. I think had we been asked for input or thoughts, we would have probably done that. So now I'm going to shift and give you Chris Way's perspective. So I think the way it was, so obviously people not unlike you who were like, what the hell, man, called me and said, I've known you for years. You've never been opposed to growing the EMS profession. I'm not opposed to growing the EMS profession. The way it was presented to me was, oh, this is going to raise people's pay. This is going to mean EMS gets paid more. This is going to raise the professionalism. This is going to solve staffing problems. Look at how, first of all, this isn't federal legislation. This is state legislation that needs to happen in every state. As it turns out, no different than a PA or a nurse practitioner, this is done in the Medical Practice Act of each state. So there can't be federal, there's no federal certification for being a paramedic. The National Registry, and I'm nationally registered, yes, has reciprocity in 41 states, I believe it is, somewhere right around there, but it's not a national certification. Your states still have to have reciprocity with each other or they have to accept the National Registry. There's no federal legislation. So in a state is going to have to take their Medical Practice Act and open this a paramedic practitioner, however this looks. The second piece is, we just got done discussing earlier, and there's no mechanism for this. So I can imagine a paramedic coming to me as an employee saying, hey, I went and got this advanced degree, and I'm an advanced practice paramedic, and I'm demanding you pay me $25,000 more a year. Well, we already talked about EMS is struggling because it's revenue-based now. If I'm not getting reimbursed anymore, to have you as a paramedic practitioner? How can I pay you $25,000 more a year? Let's talk about the staffing. If we're truly short-staffed like we say we are, and I will say, in fairness, my agency is not short-staffed. So I am probably not, for instance, I don't sit on the workforce committee because that's not my area of expertise, because that's not, our problem is not short-staffing. But we've had to, we as a community have adjusted and gone back to our the people that pay for our service and said, if we want to not be short-staffed, we are competing on a national level for paramedics. We are going to have to pay them more. I would argue that that actually right now, staffing crises are being changed not because of advanced degrees, not because of more revenue. Staffing crises are being solved because there weren't people to fill the seats. So agencies and government organizations have figured out how to pay more or why to pay more. But it's not because they're getting reimbursed anymore. They've shifted funds or done things different. And the final piece is, we couldn't, again, not even being able to provide input or look at it, I felt like I couldn't get behind the idea until I understood more. This was being, so that the National EMS Education Group, when educators are pushing this and then saying, hey, and I want to start a program, I look at it and say, man, as a guy that's running a service, not once did any of my educators call me and say, dude, is this going to help you run your ambulance service? Is this going to provide better care to the patients that are calling 911 in Kootenai County? And I can't answer that. I don't know anything about it. I was given the 7-page document and told, hey, you're a jerk if you don't support this. And believe me, I've been called much worse than a jerk over this, over NAMT's stance on this. It was not a lack of supporting education. I have a degree. Like, it's not that I'm not pro-education. If you look at our workforce now, many more people that are EMS providers have degrees, whether they're associate's degrees, bachelor's degrees, master's degrees, even doctorate degrees in EMS than at any time period. But it doesn't change the fact that there are still restrictions on how we provide EMS and how we get reimbursed for EMS. So that's Chris's opinion. And again, that and $5 doesn't even buy you a cup of coffee anymore. But now, NAMT's opinion was, we were asked to make a decision, again, on the 7-page document. We weren't asked for input. And when we talked, before we wrote the letter, the joint letter, like you said, we talked to those other organizations that you mentioned, and they weren't asked either. And so I think if NEMSAC had come to us and said, hey, we want to do a collaborative, or we're thinking about doing this, we would like a couple of people from each organization to be on a committee and weigh in and give us their thoughts, man, I think this whole thing could have gone a lot differently, or would have taken a different turn. But that wasn't ever an opportunity. And so here we are. You mentioned it was June 23rd or 27th, whatever it was. Here we are, almost 10 months or 9 months later. And instead of being any further down the railroad tracks with this, we're still just all pointing fingers and pissed off at each other. And I'm not quite sure that's what that's done. It hasn't helped NEMSAC. It hasn't helped NAMT. It hasn't helped the IAFC. It hasn't helped any of the other groups you mentioned. And so I really wish a different approach had been taken. It wasn't, had a different approach. I'm not saying the outcome would have been any different. I can't tell you what the outcome would have been, but had the approach been different, I think we would have at least taken some time and looked at it differently. Instead, again, we were put on a timeline. We need an answer back. We didn't give the answer that they wanted. So you saw what you saw on social media.
All right. I'm going to pause recording real quick. I'm going to switch my camera and then I'll be back on 1 second. So, okay. And we're recording. All right. So yeah. So first of all, I appreciate you giving the Chris perspective and then also the NAMT perspective. So in terms of, so you brought up a couple things. That one of the biggest things I was hearing was there was no collaboration going into it. So it's interesting to me that you say like the NEMSAC just kind of dropped this on you guys and didn't really ask for collaboration, where that's usually the pattern that occurs. If moving forward, because obviously there's a little bit of a disconnect right now, and there's folks that are very pro this, and there's folks that are very against this. How do you see this moving forward?
I think, listen, all sides probably should have it could have been handled better on all sides. So I think if NSAC is really NEMSAC, I'm sorry, is really, there's so many different alphabet soup. If NEMSAC is very serious about this and wants to push this through, I will tell you, I mean, I think that doing it collaboratively with us is going to be a better mechanism than working against it. That said, I think it's simply reaching out and saying, again, like I suggested earlier, look at all these organizations that came and said no, and coming back to us and say, hey, can you give us a couple of people to work on this with you and form a committee and meet? And I'm not saying at the end of that, it would be any different of a result. Maybe it would, maybe it wouldn't. That piece of that, though, there is, at least then everybody would have had the opportunity to share their opinion. I mean, I'm sure the educators aren't looking at it from my perspective. So I have several friends in EMS education, great people, great friends, been friends for a long time, but they're not looking at it from the administrative side of an ambulance service. And so they're not looking at it from the fact of, man, I can't afford, I have 47 or 48 paramedics in my organization. If every one of them, you know, makes $10,000 more a year, all of a sudden that's $480,000 more and no extra reimbursement. An educator's not looking at it from that perspective. And that's why I think doing it collaborative, I'm probably not looking at it from the education perspective. And I think there need to be medical directors involved who say, hey, as a physician, hey, this is really good. I think there need to be state leadership involved or state officials. Maybe NSEMSO needs to be involved, the state EMS officials organization, because again, you can have all the great idea, as my deputy chief says, the great idea fairy can come sprinkle dust all over us. But if no one talks to the people who make the rules and the laws, none of this matters. I mean, so we could have advanced practice paramedics in the state of Idaho, but if no one goes and talks to the legislature and the Bureau of EMS and writes standards that say an advanced practice paramedic can practice, and oh wait, here are the things that they can do under their licensure or under their skill set. Again, I could have 48 advanced practice paramedics who are still doing the same things that they're doing as a regular paramedic or in their current role. And so I just think that we haven't gotten the right people together at the table. And I would be honest and tell you, if this comes to me in my presidency of NAMT, it is not going to be Chris that represents NAMT. It'll probably, we have a lot of smart people on our board and involved in the NAMT that would probably better represent this than I do. Again, I'm looking at it simply from the administrative perspective of employing paramedics, having been a paramedic and a field provider, not being a field provider at this point, and looking at it from the administrative side, but I'm not looking at it from the training side. I'm not looking at it from the initial education side of running a program that does advanced practice paramedics. I'm not looking at it from the state side. So I think getting those people together and collaborating, at least having NEMSAC explain what they want to do with us and the goals, and then hopefully being open to saying, you know, to looking at the different perspectives sitting around the table. But that opportunity was not given.
You know,
That's very fair. Oh, no, go ahead,
I was going to say that's in Chris's world. That's the next logical step.
Yeah, I just, you know, as Moose knows, there's so much to say about this. And I love controversy. I also love consensus. And I think it is very important, especially for readers that may not be familiar with the intricacies, or listeners, that what you're hearing is that you have to have an understanding of the complexity for what it's worth. And this is probably not worth more than the $5 that you mentioned earlier. I totally agree with you. Because if we don't map this out and figure out, I mean, in my career, I've done EMS education, medical direction for EMS, providers, all sorts of services. And if we don't figure out, you know, is there appetite? Can it be reimbursed? What are we going to do with these providers? What are the educational incentives? This initiative would be doomed to fail. Not because it's a bad idea from the idea fairy, but we've got to figure out, you know, based upon the reality of the landscape. And this goes back to all the other issues we talk about. All of the issues don't change. They're just issues of scale that are modified in particular regard to the EMS system that you're talking about. So paramedic practitioner, you know, maybe there's some great ideas in terms of how do we look at this to advance recruitment and retention. But I can tell you from what I've seen, if you're going to go to a lot of the community colleges and say, hey, let's start this up, it may be a non-starter if they can't figure out how to get tuition because people aren't going to be reimbursed. So it's not that it's a non-starter at all, but we have to look at, as we said, going back to the beginning of the landscape, we have to figure out where they fit in based upon the reality and the pragmatic sort of structure of our own EMS systems. And once you have those people at the table, I think there's a lot of room for local advocacy. You know, speaking in my own challenged EMS jurisdiction, I think the way we've been able to get stuff through is because you get a lot of local consensus, you have a deep understanding of the challenges, and you level set expectations. And this is something that I think has to go through a similar synthesis, because we can address all these things, but I think there is not a lot of alignment with respect to the education, the practice pattern, the reimbursement, and the scope of what this profession would do. So I think at the end of the day, it's still a lot of dialogue that needs to happen. That's well said.
Yeah, and you know, this topic, you know, one, I do support there being paramedic practitioners in some way and somehow in the future. I think it's a great idea. I think it has some great purpose that could lend itself to how we deliver medical care to our community going forward. But it is very multifaceted, as the doc pointed out, as Chris has pointed out. We can't just think of it as, hey, let's get this certification, this licensure out there on the table. It's there. It's a federal thing. We got to do it. Find your own way. No, we got to look at how do we, one, change the scheduling for Medicare so we can actually get money back into the system so that there is a basis for this to work. Because if there's no money, it doesn't work. There's no money to stand up the education program. There's no money to reimburse the person that is actually doing the job. It doesn't work. It falls apart. We have to look at the education systems. We have to look at, you know, right now, you know, while there are a lot of degree holders in EMS, I'd say probably the degree holders that are EMS degrees are on the lower end.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah. And so like our bachelor programs, they're just burgeoning more and more. And we're still figuring out what does a bachelor of paramedicine look like? You know, there's some institutions, UMBC and EKU, that have been doing it for years. UMBC just celebrated 40 years last year, you know, and so they've kind of figured it out, but nationwide, that's not figured out. So then what do we figure out? What does a master's of paramedicine look like? And I've heard from other content creators that one of their big hangups, and I have to agree with them on this, is do we see a burgeoning of fly-by-night programs that then take what all this hard work and everything we envision this to be and make it not what we want it to be? And so like, this is a lot harder to look at and do than I think most people think. And you have to look at all portions of it. And hopefully, and I have to ask Chris, you know, do you think, and I think I know the answer to this, do you think that the fact that there is no federal representation or federal office that manages EMS is a hindrance to this being a possibility, because there's no direct path to a government agency?
I'm going to surprise you by my answer, and I would say not on this issue specifically, because I would go back to, I think this is more of a state issue. You can't create a federal level of paramedic practice because it's a state issue. So, I mean, you go back, Maryland may look at this much differently than Idaho, which may look at it much differently than any other state. In Maryland, you may say, oh, you have a master's degree, advanced practice paramedic. Yes, they can do the following scope of practice. In Idaho, they may say, oh, no, wait, it's got to be done completely different. Look at critical care transport. Critical care transport is the perfect example. We are actually a ground critical care transport provider. And we take care of the ground critical care transport for the northern five counties of Idaho. Our agency does. But not every paramedic that's a separate certification, separate licensure in the state of Idaho, separate requirements. In order to do a critical care transport in Idaho, you have to have either the flight medic certification or the ground critical care certification. You cannot be the only provider in the back of the ambulance. So you've got to be with another advanced provider so you have to have another paramedic in the back, you know, not a critical care paramedic. There must be a paramedic. And I mean, so there's some different requirements. But if you go across the state line, we border Washington. In Washington, you can do a critical care transport with a paramedic by themselves in the back of an ambulance. I mean, so this is
different issues,
but this is a lot the same. In this isn't a federal issue. There are things on the federal reimbursement, totally affected by the fact that we do not have a federal home for EMS at the federal level. This, I truly believe, is a state, more of a state issue. And I think probably the thing that has offended me personally, I'm going to put Chris's hat back on, not the NAMT hat. The thing that has probably offended me the most of the fallout of this is being labeled anti-education. No, I'm not anti it. In fact, I've gone back and gotten education. I support it. I just am not. No one has been able to tell me how this is going to improve patient care in my community. And until somebody can tell me that, I don't know that I can get behind it. No one's been able to tell me that the person who calls 911 with chest pain in Kootenai County, Idaho tomorrow, how the difference would be between having a ground critical care paramedic versus a quote unquote normal paramedic versus having an advanced practice paramedic. Because ultimately what that patient needs is to get to the cath lab, to get to a STEMI center and get to a cath lab. There are cool things that we can do in EMS, but some of the basics of EMS don't change. And no one has been able to tell me other than, well, it's really good for the workforce. So I'll pat ourselves on the back, and this is our organization. We just hired 16 new firefighters. We're opening a new station. We had 312 qualified applicants. We had many more applicants. 312 qualified people wanted to come work here. And other people are telling us. But we've taken care of salary. Advanced practice paramedic is not going to be what solves the job crisis. In fact, what you're seeing is it has become so hard to get your EMT and your paramedic. I don't know that putting additional degree requirements on staffing is going to solve. It's actually going to have a negative effect on the staffing shortage and provider shortage in EMS in the United States. Are there niches where this could be amazing and do great things? Could it really help an MIH program? Heck yeah. Could it really help a small rural community where that doesn't have physicians or mid-level practitioners? Hell yeah. There are some really cool things the advanced practice provider, paramedic provider could do. Is it going to dramatically affect 911 systems in the provision of 911 ambulance service? I don't think it will.
No, I mean, I agree. You know, when we talked about this with Dave Pfeiffer, we talked about how like this is not like so much your classic 911 EMS type role. This is definitely a very niche thing that while, yes, you can still do those things, they're handling that MIH level community paramedicine type stuff, and they're expanding the capabilities of the agency. And to go back to what you're saying, Chris, about it's at a state thing, you know, currently the only agencies that do it are mostly delegated practice agencies. I believe there's one state that had not, don't quote me on this, there could be other ones. And we only know this because we talked to Dave Pfeiffer, but Kentucky has an advanced practice level at the state level, but everyone else, it's delegated practice agencies. The one that comes to mind for most people is Austin Travis County EMS in Texas, and Texas is a delegated practice state. So they're able to decide that interagency within the state and not have to involve federal or other outside agencies. You know, so here in Maryland, totally different.
You brought up Austin Travis County. One of our NAMT board members is the new chief of Austin Travis. Well, he's not new now. He's been there for a little over a year, but is the chief of Austin Travis County. He would tell you, and has said this in NAMT meetings, this in the way it was presented would not make an impact on the delivery of EMS in Austin Travis County, Texas.
Okay.
And he has full-time physicians working under his...
Don't forget about the PAs.
He's got PAs that are responding to calls already. Mm-hmm. And they're not getting reimbursed for that. So, I mean, that is a perfect example of, again, theoretically, there's a lot of good that could come. Well, why wouldn't we want more education? Why wouldn't we want people better trained? All those things. But at some point, the reality sinks in. Are we taking already short-staffed 911 provider agencies and short-staffing them more because we're transitioning these people to alternate roles? There's no reimbursement. So an agency that already is struggling to meet their financial burden is now trying to figure out how more to meet their, you know, how worse to meet their financial burden. Man, and Austin Travis County is well funded. He would tell you they're one of the best funded EMS agencies in the country, if not the best funded per citizen, per provider, type thing. Again, they have a medical director. I think they have five associate medical directors. They have several PAs that work underneath them. I mean, they're not lacking for funds to be able to do great initiatives, but he's saying, I don't see this making an impact. I got to take that under consideration.
Yeah. So I see it not making an impact for them because they already have those providers though. Right. So I have a couple comments on what everyone has said. Right. So, I want to go through the recommendations because I think they address what you guys are talking about. Right. So first and foremost, we talk about there being no money, right? So part of these recommendations that they're describing address that, right? So recommendation number two. So FICEMS should ask the Secretary of HHS to designate paramedics who possess clinically focused graduate level degrees as qualified practitioners to the Secretary's authority under Section 1842 of the Social Security Act. Let's see, recommendation number three. FICMS should ask the Secretary of HHS to direct CMS to designate paramedics who possess clinically focused graduate level degrees as qualified practitioners in all applicable regulations. So CMS, right, we already talked about, yes, there's state level law that dictates licensure, right? But CMS is the major payer, right? So when we're talking about money, we're addressing those two points. In terms of education, Josh, I would argue that recommendation four meets that standard, right? It says FICMS should ask the Secretary of HHS to direct the Health Resources and Services Administration to designate funding for the establishment of clinically focused Master of Paramedic Science programs at accredited colleges and universities to prepare paramedic practitioners in cooperation with the Department of Education. So I agree that that could have been worded a little bit better, but I don't think anyone's trying to do these fly-by-night programs that you discussed. To push back a little bit on the staffing issue next, right, I would argue that I see where you're coming from with we're going to be pulling this finite resource that we have, right, that we are already struggling to staff trucks. I 1,000% agree with you on that. But I think there's that caveat that we're losing people already. Right. The NAMT themselves did the surveys that were cited in this recommendation that people are losing for or leaving for a variety of reasons, one of them being not having advancements. So I kind of see this as a means to try to retain people. Now, why am I against the PANP route? Because I imagine many paramedics, if given the opportunity, would want to work as a pre-hospital practitioner because that's where they've cut their teeth. If we just tell them, oh, go be a PA or an NP, quite frankly, I imagine a sizable portion of them will go leave and function somewhere else more established, whether it's an ICU somewhere, whether it's an emergency department or an urgent care. I don't see that. I'm kind of surprised by that because I see it as a way to stem the tide. Now, I see where you're coming from an administrative perspective in terms of, how are you going to pay these people? Well, I'm not sure I think that's what would happen if today we created a graduate degree somewhere, one that I'm in right now as a graduate student, where I know for a fact, if I was working as a paramedic, I'm not going to make any more money. But that being said, if there was this federal recognition at the payer level, then that opportunity to make more money is there. I was also surprised to see the IFF and the IFC on here because I see it as more income for the fire service. I mean, if we're able to bill at the paramedic practitioner level, we are saving money by not paying a ton of overtime in the magical world where we are able to keep more people, but we're also able to bill more, right? We're able to get more funds. So that was just my initial thoughts. I have a few more thoughts, but I wanted to give the chief an opportunity to respond.
I don't have any thoughts on number four, but on number two, on the money, I do have a thought. So what makes you think, as you read the number two description, that that's going to work? We've been fighting for payment reform since it came out in 19 in how to reimburse EMS. And the educators are now going to be the ones that go push this through. And because there's some new, I'm not seeing that. I think, again, had you gotten some agency administrators who truly understand billing and revenue in the conversation, it's not as simple as going and doing title or section 18 title, whatever you said it was under Health and Human Services.
And I'm with you on that, but from a, and I get where you come from in terms of difficulty, right? The stuff that you described earlier in the episode with the legislature, the federal legislature is, you know, moves like a snail. But I don't think that then absolves the responsibility to try, right? I mean, to try and push through the, like, you know, the, like the CMS funding.
But okay. But again, I'll ask the question. You didn't, they didn't, not you, but they didn't do it collaboratively. And so no one came to me as an agency administrator and said, what are your biggest issues in revenue collection?
Yeah, that I can agree with. The whole collaboration thing, for the record, I 1000% agree. Like when you said that nobody like approached you, I mean, which obviously you wouldn't have written a letter like this, not you specifically, but the NAMT and everyone else wouldn't have signed on.
It was all the agencies.
Yeah. I mean, like you guys wouldn't have signed on something for if they had collaborated with you. That I'm with you, right? I get where you're coming from.
But no one came to me as an EMS agency administrator and said, what legislation would impact you the most? I would tell you, look at Dr. Lawner's comment about his 185,000 calls. They transport 90,000, which I'm not super good at math, means they don't transport 95. Is this going to make a bigger difference, or is the TIP legislation, treatment in place legislation, going to make a bigger difference for his agency? No one came to agency administrators and asked that question.
I get where you're coming from with that. The maybe you could also describe that folks, I don't think understand that lobbyist currency is a finite resource, right? You can only promote so much legislation. That was one of the things that once it was explained to me, I understood better. You have to have prioritization in what you're pushing for, and you kind of have to push for low-hanging fruit. So maybe you can provide some
low-hanging fruit, but if you only have so much political capital to spend, then you've got to spend it on what's going to make the biggest impact for the profession.
Exactly.
If you have $5 to spend on a project and TIP is going to cost us $4 of that, but it's going to have the biggest return on investment, spending $3 on a program that doesn't have a greater return on investment, and then now not being able to spend any money or spend any effort, and I say money, but political capital on a bill that doesn't have as high a likelihood or doesn't have as big an impact into the profession, I can't get behind that. I got to go with what's going to have. I represent EMS as a whole, and not a certain segment of EMS. Again, not a certain provider type of EMS, not the educators, not the I represent EMS as a whole. And so my charge as the advocacy chairman and the incoming president is I've got to figure out what the biggest bang for my buck, and my buck is the EMS profession. So what is the biggest bang we can put our time, our resources, our money, our lobbyists, our effort into? And I don't know that it's this legislation.
And that I can, well, to be clear, it's not legislation, right?
Proposal.
Exactly. What I would ask, though, you bring up an interesting thing. So what I'm getting from what you're saying is that there's multiple reasons you're against it. But from the NAMT perspective, it's a lack of, like you said, political current, or what did you say? You didn't say political capital. Currency. Capital, exactly. Yeah. So I don't know. I don't see obviously they would ask you guys to sign on to this, but couldn't there be I don't think there's a dichotomy there, right? So there could be a world where you guys are in support of it, but aren't spending your capital, because I think there's a middle ground somewhere, right?
I think there probably is. I will tell you, I don't think we will support it as it's currently written.
Sure. Yeah, so absolutely. Again, yeah.
Come back.
Well,
to
number one, like I agree with you. Like why, if I was in your position, I'm not sure I would like support something that I had zero like input on. So I get where you're coming from with that.
But so let's back up. Let's say they come back to all of the organizations that you listed, NAMT, IFF, IFC, AAA. And I think there was one more, was there not, that you listed earlier?
I'm just reading from the thing, the AAA, IFC, IFF, and the NAMT.
Okay, so the four of us collectively wrote a letter, all agreeing on the language of the letter. That represents a lot of EMS providers in the United States. I'm guessing Josh is probably a member of the IAFF. I am a member. Not only am I the president-elect of NAMT, I'm also a member of the IAFC as a fire chief. I mean, so you're talking about a lot of different providers in the world providing EMS who all signed on and said, can't support it. So,
I would disagree with you there. I would disagree with you there because sure, there are card holding people, But I, the uproar that came up, right? So look at me, somebody like me, right? I joined because I was figuring out what was going on. I would say that, you know, the project itself has a pretty decent sense of what folks' opinions are. I imagine a lot of them are NAEMT members. I imagine that a lot of them are IAFF members. And certainly that there have been people that are very vocal for something like this that openly say that they are members of each. So I'm not sure that is, I don't think you there's a unilateral representation like you're describing.
I don't think there's a unilateral representation. I'm not saying every member. What I'm saying is the elected board, though, who, and our elected board and the elected boards of these other organizations are very diverse in where they're coming. I mean, we have educators. We have.
Sure. Absolutely.
We have a physician. We have Firebase. We have third service providers like Rob Luckritz from Austin Travis County. We have privates represented. I think we have four educators, and no one said, "Oh my God, this is the bee's knees. Let's get this deal."
God's gift to EMS. No, I'm with you. Yeah.
And so again, I think to go back to your question of what would NAEMT do? Well, first of all, if we had something. A better product to support, I think we could support it. And if we support it, then we're going to put political capital behind it.
Yeah.
But in order to support it, we either need to completely agree with the way it's written, which we obviously don't, or we need to have some collaboration. I mean, for instance, I'll tell you, just today we had an NAEMT advocacy committee call. We got one of the senators from Texas reached out and said, "I want NAEMT support on a bill I'm writing." And he said, "But I want your feedback to get NAEMT support." We said, "Hey, we feel like," he listed the word EMT only. And we said, "You know what? That's a non-starter for us. It needs to be EMS providers or providers," because it was talking about legislation who to better support if you're killed in the line of duty. Well, obviously we want to support, but the way the bill was written, it only covered EMTs. And somebody could come back on a technicality and argue, what happens to the person who was a first responder and a driver only was driving the ambulance when the ambulance was in a wreck? That doesn't cover them. So again, but that's a senator reaching out to be collaborative, and we couldn't get NEMSAC to be collaborative. I think if we do that, it's a game changer. This whole narrative changes. This whole uproar for the last 9 months is totally different if that happens. Do not mistake that for me saying all of a sudden NAEMT would support it. But NAEMT is much more likely to support it. And I would tell you, most of the people that wrote that probably didn't reach out to administrators of EMS or medical directors of EMS, or even, I mean, maybe they reached out to providers, but if I was in the provider's seat and you said, and your only call to me was, "Listen, Mustafa, here's the deal, man. I'm writing some stuff down and it's going to get you a 40% raise in your salary." You'd be like, "Hell yeah, I'm signing on today." Never mind the fact that you didn't talk to any administrator who would go, "I can't afford a 40% raise for half of my paramedics. I can't, there's, doesn't generate more revenue." I mean, all of it's got to flow together where we can say the revenue provided in your Section 2 comment is great. We've addressed how we're going to get them educated. We've addressed that, we've gone out and done a study of providers that says that, yes, this will actually retain providers, not send people to nursing school or respiratory therapy school or medical school. None of that was done. This paper was written and here we are. And
I'm getting an overarching sense here that the biggest, I shouldn't say the word, I should word this very carefully. The biggest concern that I'm hearing here is the lack of collaboration. Would that be correct?
I would say yes. We still have legitimate concerns about the effect of it, but yes,
sure.
The absolute biggest thing, well, you're asking a difficult question, because if you're asking me, to be clear, NAEMT did not write or did not sign onto the letter because of a lack of collaboration. NAEMT signed onto the letter because of what was put in the letter and the circumstances. Yeah. Had we been given the opportunity to collaborate, I think maybe the 7-page document could have looked different and it would have been more palatable to those four organizations that signed the letter.
Yeah. No, that's fair. Ed, I didn't mean to paint you into a corner there. I apologize for that. But I see where you're coming from, and I agree with you. More so, I'm thinking of like root causes of like things getting to where they are right now, where there is, you know, like you said, significant disagreement and on the ground, significant anger towards each of these professional organizations that are quite frankly disappointed, because to me, the surface, the NAMT is the single professional organization that's supposed to be advocating for the advance of my profession, mm-hmm. and they turn around and completely abandon it, right? So that's what on the surface that looks like. And I mean, that's why I appreciate this conversation, right? Because certainly, you know, we disagree, but we disagree. I mean, we agree more than we probably, than I did with you, before we started recording. So where do we go from here?
On this issue specifically?
Sure.
I think NEMSAC's first move, if NEMSAC has choices, right? They can try to run this as it is, but you're going to see, if they move forward with the document as it is, you're going to see those four organizations not just write a letter, but you're going to see those four organizations on Capitol Hill absolutely opposing. I think so. If there's truly the desire to move this, not necessarily in its current state, I can't say that, but if there's desire to truly create some sort of a next level paramedic advanced practitioner, or if there's some mechanism to look at how we change the dynamics of some of this, I think there's an opportunity to get groups together, involve people. Again, though, I'm not sure this is a federal issue. I still think there's some of this that is much more of a state issue than a federal issue.
Yeah.
And so that's got to be worked out too. The federal issue comes into payment reimbursement reform.
Yeah.
You know, this is obviously a complex issue, and I know that we probably, not to set expectations, may not solve that within the time remaining, but I just wanted to underscore this issue of collaboration, because what I'm hearing is it's not about asking permission. It's not just about, hey, by the way, we should have talked to you about this. I think it is a much broader issue, because the real challenge that I've seen, you know, let's take it back to where we were before, you know, EMS and COVID, we started having EMS do all these things, but there is still a broad-based illiteracy about what EMS does, what their qualifications are, the educational standards. So if we really want to move this forward, which I think all of us agree that there can be an advanced practice kind of paramedic, but in order to get that sort of operationalized, as you asked, where do we go from here? We've got to figure out very basic issues like, how do we standardize the education? How do paramedics function in a hospital? I find it absurd that when we systematized, meaning in my critical care transport organization, and made our paramedic system employees, do you know how it took me years, literally years, to get them any degree of pay parity with registered nurses? Because we don't speak the language, we don't have the certifications, the education's very different, the HR people. So when you talk about collaboration, I just want to underscore the fact that I hear that it is a lot more than asking people for support. It's really getting at these fundamental issues of how do we move forward as a profession? And that has important ramifications to the standardization, the scope of practice, the oversight, and all those other things. So maybe we do agree more than we disagree.
I would agree completely with what Dr. Lawner just said. I mean, that he hit the nail on the head. Like, it is not just support for a document. It is so much deeper than, and so with all due respect, Mustafa, I think the people that are ticked off in the world, and you more, you know, you made the comment, more people are mad than aren't about this, don't understand that this isn't as simple as writing a letter, that, you know, all of those aspects go into advanced practice paramedics.
Yeah, no, and I'm with you. But what I would say to that, though, is it's the responsibility of the organizations to bring that information to its members, though, right? So that leads me to my next question. Why, and again, not necessarily directed at you, because obviously it's an organization, why, as a member of the NAMT, why is the first time that I'm hearing about this lack of collaboration tonight and not when all this happened?
So remember what I said earlier. I don't think you're going to see us. Please don't take this as disparaging NEMSAC.
No.
I'm simply saying how I think it could have been solved and why I'm telling you why it didn't.
Yeah, no, that's fair. Again,
go back to what I said with how we handle all the other. We have such a collegial relationship with all those other organizations mentioned that I don't know that you're going to see us come out and say, and people are going to have their own interpretation. I actually think NAMT's stance was, we don't support this in its current form. It's not that we don't support education, but people read into what they want. They hear, they see the stuff on social media. I mean, I saw the stuff on social media. We all got called names on social media. I get it. Like, I can't change those opinions. And I'm hope. Well, do I hope that doing this podcast and the three of you somewhat agreeing with my mm-hmm. stance. Do I hope that helps? Absolutely. Am I dumb enough to think that? No, I mean, good God, we're already in election season, and I see it on both. Like, I'm ready to be done with the presidential election. I'm already sick of it.
Yeah. Can we start on that?
And so that's a lot of it. Like, there's going to be some people who I think we can change their minds. There are some people who this wasn't, I don't want to minimize this. I don't.
Yeah.
But again, in the circles I run in, this was a brief topic of conversation. This has not been the biggest pressing issue in EMS over the last 9 months.
Yeah.
Staffing shortages. How are we going to get more paramedics? Not advanced practice. How are we going to create, how are we going to make it so that we can send more people to paramedic school? Because we actually have a shortage of paramedic education available. Reimbursement, you know, look at what's happened in healthcare. And my wife's a nurse. And it's funny because I see the same lines. She has several friends that went to nurse practitioner school. My wife's an ER nurse. She is making more an hour as a floor ER nurse than they are as nurse practitioners because the demand, right? That's what's going to drive this. Why do you think people are, that is what's changed. And that's what's bankrupt some EMS systems and some local governments is they're now paying firefighters and paramedics and law enforcement officers more than they've ever paid them. And that's just because they've had to. That's what's driving staffing short. I hear that. So when you tell me how, or you, when you say, you know, when I hear you say, oh, this is, you know, this is such a big deal, man, those are the things I hear about. I'm not downplaying this, or I'm not trying to marginalize this at all and say this isn't an issue. But those are the things I hear on an everyday basis. I don't hear about whether or not we should have advanced practice paramedics on a daily basis.
Say is for the NEM, I hesitate to say more pressing, but to me, yeah, a little bit more pressing to stop the hemorrhaging, right, before we can start doing, you know, addressing these things. And Chief, I got to say, I appreciate you coming on and talking to us.
I appreciate the opportunity. Like I said, I'm not even asking everybody to agree with me. I just think it's important that we share our point of view. And if we have spoken to, not me personally, so, but we as NAMT have spoken to NEMSAC and suggested other avenues to try to, and I don't know where that's at, to be honest. I can't answer that tonight and tell you that. Would I welcome that under my presidency? Yes. Please do not mistake that for me saying that this is a priority during my presidency. I think getting payment reform is a priority. Looking at workforce shortages is a priority. Looking how do we change what we haven't changed for 25 years in an environment that is changing on a daily basis? Those are things that are tangible and meaningful to, I don't care whether it's the first responder level and a volunteer service in Idaho, or whether it's the largest paid, you know, one of the largest paid services like Baltimore City, where Dr. Lawner's, you know, the medical director, or anywhere in between. And there's a lot of in-betweens in EMS, but there are issues that are more pressing than this. Not to say this isn't an issue, not to say we shouldn't look at it more or do something different, but that's kind of where I'm at.
Last time I'll say anything, but I would argue that a lot of these issues, like, for example, having a dead end career, right? For example, not having anywhere to go would be solved. And people, we'd be able to keep people, but I get where you come from.
Well,
I'll put my
shameless plug in for the fire. I don't have paramedics leaving. I have paramedics promoting.
Well,
and I have, but I don't
a unique situation to where you are.
We have not had a voluntary resignation in 5 years. We've had retirements after 30 years of service.
Yeah.
But maybe we put our efforts into creating good cultures. Maybe we, you know, maybe we don't beat our providers up. Maybe we put better, you know, more providers on the street. Look, you know,
yeah, you make a more sustainable environment, arguably.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. No, I appreciate
that's going
this.
To be more. That's going to be more impactful to EMS as a profession than creating a advanced practice paramedic.
I'd say it's equal effort, but that's where we can agree to disagree.
Yeah.
Hey, this was great. I want to make sure I give Dr. Lohner and Josh, I kind of took over there for a second. Any comments? Closing comments, I should say.
I'm good. Josh, you first. A lot of what was said, I'd say. But everything that was talked about was great. I think it was a great opportunity to not only talk about like what the NEMT does, some of the stuff that's going on the Hill, some of the progression that you guys are actively working on that is actually going to affect every provider out there, not just advanced practice providers, but then also getting a look behind the curtain on what happened back in June and what has kind of been the focal point of a lot of people's anger with NAMT, IFC, AAA, and IFF over this advanced provider topic. And getting to talk about it, understand the multifaceted portions of it. Not saying that we didn't understand it before, not saying that our listeners didn't understand it before, but maybe there's some things that people didn't think about when it came down to this.
Yeah.
And absolutely. Just puts it in more perspective, you know, life and everything is you can agree to disagree on things. And we didn't all come to agreement on this. We didn't all disagree on this tonight. And that's why we're having this conversation. That's why we wanted to do this, so that there was an opportunity for Chris to have the voice for himself and the NAEMT, and for us to have the voice of some of our listeners, our own thoughts and feelings about it. And that's what we did. And it was great.
I mean, because what I would say, I want to give Dr. Lerner an opportunity, but what I would say is a lot of people got really pissed off at this, but what Alert Medic One wanted to do was actually talk to the folks and have a dialogue, right? Because I don't think what we just did tonight happens a lot anymore. No. I think people kind of like the safety of their silos. They like getting, I'm not targeting anyone, but like they like the safety of their social media pages that are very much curated to what they want to see. And I think folks don't like to reach out to the other side and be like, hey, let's just have a conversation. You know, we're like, this felt like a conversation that we'd have at a restaurant, you know what I mean? Or anything
absolutely.
That, you know what I mean? So, I think there's a deeper lesson also learned of if we're not agreeing with folks, you know, there's much more value in sitting down and having a conversation, than, maybe attacking people. Cause I'll be honest with you, we had a position paper ready to publish and we chose not to do that, because I wanted to do this conversation. Right. Does the position paper change that much? Yeah. I'm probably going to change the verbiage to be a little bit nicer.
We appreciate that.
Yeah. You know, but, still, I mean, like Josh said, it's okay to agree to disagree. And I kind of find that I agree with you on more things that I thought I would. So Dr. Lerner, go ahead.
No, I would just say thanks, Chief. It was great to hear from you and Moose and Josh for the forum. I think what people should take away from this is that these issues are complex. And you know, I've changed my own social media postings because you can't possibly have a dialogue when there's no back and forth. And you don't understand the perspective and the reasons. And these problems that affect EMS are universal. And it really comes down to advocacy and a true understanding of a lot of those challenges. And in order to get through this disagreement, I think we have to resist this urge of saying, you know what, it's really simple. It's really just a lack of bachelor's degrees that's causing all the lack of, you know, it's causing all the problems. So what I really appreciate about this forum is the opportunity for some honesty and a deeper dive. But yeah, I can't advocate enough for the honesty and collaboration that needs to take place when we're looking at these big issues, because whether you're in the amazing system that has no turnover in Idaho or my own system where we turn over, I think, every 5 minutes, I think there's some challenges that are universal to all of us. So I appreciate it and just wanted to thank you again. Really great dialogue. I'd echo all that's been said.
What I would also say is the ball's kind of in the NEMSAC's court now, right? Like we have this forum. The NAEMT has come and talked to us, right? Obviously, those other entities, the AAA and all, IFC and IFF, sure, if they want to come on, I don't imagine they would want to. But I think the ball's in the court. If anyone from the NEMSAC or anyone else disagreed, the you guys can always come on. Just shoot us an email at admin@alertmedic1.com and we will we'll consider it. I'm not going to say we're going to just let you on, but we'll consider it. And after talking to the team, we'll, you know, come on and let's, you know, tell your side of the story.
I just want to thank you guys for the opportunity. Like I said, I mean, I think it's important to hear multiple sides of the story. And listen, we're not going to stop advocating for EMS, and we may not disagree, but again, 32 years into it, I still love what I wake up every morning and I'm living my dream. So I still get to do what I set out to do as a young guy. And this, something like this, it shouldn't deter us. Something like this should embolden us to want to do it more, to collaborate, to work with people. I mean, I think we're stronger when we see the different opinions, and we need to be willing to listen to NEMSAC's whys of why they wrote it, but they need to be willing to listen to ours. And if we can do that, man, I think we have I think this conversation that we've had over the last 2 hours is a much different conversation than in a year from now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome. Well, Chief, thanks for coming on and talking to us about the NEMT and the position that was taken on the advanced practice providers. thank you to all of our listeners out there. If you're not following us on social media, follow us on Alert Medic One on Instagram and Facebook. Stay tuned for a lot of great content that we're pushing out constantly. And wherever you are, have a good night, good evening, or good morning, and be safe. See you, everybody.